It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios, welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me, or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You all right?
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4-1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for. Coming to you live from CPAC, that noisy place at the Gaylord Hotel in National Harbor, Maryland. And of course, you'll never know who's going to come by and who just came by. I knew he was coming by. Former UN Ambassador John Bolton, who I've known for a long time. I think we got to know each other, John, over North Korea when I was the chairman of the North Korea Freedom Coalition. That's
right.
When I first got acquainted with you. But you know who Ambassador Bolton is. He has been with the American Enterprise Institute for years, but he's got his own organization now and actually formed his own super PAC. And you may raise like $20 million for candidates.
Over the last 3 years, yeah.
And had like a, 75% win rate?
Right, and we were prepared to take a lot of risks. The point of the PAC and the super PAC, and I've got a foundation too, is to help educate the people about why national security should be at the top of the political debate. Because if we're not secure as a nation, really everything else is secondary. But also to get people into the House and the Senate who understand why this has got to be the central issue.
What's your litmus test? I mean, it can't be just knowledge. It has to be their ideology, too. So what is your litmus test for supporting Canada?
Well, I think at bottom, they've got to believe in Ronald Reagan's philosophy of peace through strength, that a strong America is much more likely to be able to protect our interests and our friends around the world and avoid hostilities. This is the fundamental mistake Barack Obama made. He thought America was too strong and we provoked people and made things worse. In fact, a weak America is much more provocative because our adversaries know they can take advantage of us. And that's what they've done for 8 years.
I'm jumping ahead 20 questions here, but I just have to ask you, you know, I was reading a headline a couple of weeks ago that ISIS fighters are calling in sick, like they don't want to go into battle. Like there's, and I, of course, the thing that struck me was, look, there's a big, there's a new guy in the White House who's rattling a big saber. And do you think that, I mean, that's a headline that could or could not be the case. Do you think that he's having an effect, Donald Trump, on the courage of the Islamic fighters? Any effect at all?
I think so. Look, they watch American campaigns almost as much as we do everywhere around the world. What happens in America affects everybody. They heard the tough talk that candidate Trump said about destroying ISIS. They know now that he's asked for a military review by the Pentagon. We expect it within a matter of weeks. And they know that the campaign is going to accelerate against ISIS in western Iraq and Syria. So my guess is not only are they calling in sick, they're finding ways to get out of Dodge to go to Libya or Yemen or some other uncontrolled place where they can set up shop again.
Let me get personal with you. You know, people know you best now because they see you on Fox all the time. And thank goodness for that. And one of the things that strikes me, because I'm a generalist, is your knowledge of the world. I mean, honestly, you have made yourself a student of the world. I'm wondering if when you were UN ambassador, of course, you had to start that process. I know you've well read, certainly highly educated, but that doesn't mean you know everything about what's going on in the world. So have you really kind of like taken it on just to target various parts of the world and become expert on them?
Well, I just because of the jobs I've had in the government, it's put me in a circumstance where I really have to know pretty much the whole world. And what it says to me is that you need a coherent American foreign policy on a global basis. These things are not unrelated. Because what the United States does in one area, other countries watch and make their own judgments on. So actually, when I speak today at CPAC this afternoon, I'm going to argue we've got to keep a principled American conservative foreign policy going here, whatever the vicissitudes that happen electorally. It's critically important, given the Obama Democratic Party, that we not lose sight of that.
Because national security is like a natural affinity, I just have an affinity for it because I hang out with national security types. My impression, John, Ambassador Bolton, is that one of the nut issues here is the Muslim Brotherhood and its influence, not only in this country, but on the world. You know, there's legislation Ted Cruz has sponsored and others in the House to make the Muslim Brotherhood, designate them a terrorist organization. Where do you stand on that?
I'm absolutely in favor of that. I hope the Trump administration does it first. We've got a statutory framework to decide what amounts to a foreign terrorist organization. The Muslim Brotherhood meets it in spades. It's already been designated a terrorist organization by many Arab countries who understand that the Brotherhood is a threat to them. We know that Hamas in the Gaza Strip, the terrorist group there, is a wholly owned subsidiary of the Muslim Brotherhood. Obviously, Obama wasn't going to go anywhere close to it, but I think our Arab friends in the Middle East would strongly support our designation.
Do you think that the Islamic State is Islamic?
Of course it is. And, you know, who better to explain the nature of this problem? I try and get people to focus on King Abdullah of Jordan, who is a Muslim king of a Muslim country. And he describes what we're talking about as a civil war within Islam. Who is going to control the future of the religion, the radicals or the sane people? Now, look, if that's an analysis that's good enough for a Muslim king, why isn't it good enough for us?
Well, interestingly enough, the gentleman who took the spot as National Security Advisor made a public statement that he did not believe the Islamic State was part of Islam. And that's very concerning to many people. And I have to say, John, you don't have to weigh in on this, but I personally was very disappointed that you were not chosen. All right, I know there are other spots in the Trump administration. Any hints on what, you know, are you still having? You've got to be there. You just got to be.
Well, if you hear anything, let me know.
All right, well, you never know. I've got a tin can and a string, so. No, I just have to know some Democratic operatives or some of the press that they can tell me what's going on in both of us, yeah. All right, so. Let's talk about Russia because you know why. So we have this narrative that from the left that Russia interfered with our elections. And then we have this narrative that Donald Trump and his staff, whoever cooperated, whether it was Lieutenant General
Flynn
or others, you know, campaign operatives before that. That's the narrative. Of course, we know now that the FBI is investigated. There really is no there. But in the issue of Russia, because they play so many double and triple games, they always have. It's very hard to know, isn't it, about what they have and haven't done. What can you tell us about what they might have done to influence our elections?
Well, I haven't seen any of the classified material. I have talked to House and Senate members who have, and I don't have any doubt in my mind, based on what they saw, that Russia was trying to have an impact on the election. They did try and break into Republican National Committee computer files.
I thought they were trying. I thought it was all helping the Democrats.
Yeah, you know, look, this is what is hard for the left wing narrative to explain. If I were in the Kremlin, I'd much rather have had Hillary Clinton as president because I knew I could push her around the same way I pushed Obama around. Trump may agree with Putin on one issue or another, but the key thing from the Kremlin's perspective is he's a strong leader. And is not going to take American interest being abused the way Hillary Clinton, I think, would have. So at bottom, I think what Russia probably wanted to achieve was just lessening Americans' faith in their own institutions, that we come not to trust the Constitution to allow a free and fair election. And by sowing that kind of dissension, that suits them too. So we're going to see, I think these congressional investigations should go forward, but we're also going to see in Europe later this year a lot of elections where the Europeans are very worried the Russians are trying to interfere there.
Putin, of course, is a strong man. Donald Trump is a strong man. So my just impression as I try to analyze it is that Putin, I think, certainly has a respect for a change for Donald Trump. But it's also bad news for them because Donald Trump, President Trump, is going to be, as you said, much harder to deal with. He's not going to whisper to the Russian president that I'll have more, you know,
flexibility
yeah. After I'm elected again. That would be treason under any other definition. But that's what President Barack Obama whispered off mic. All right, so now they know they have a man that they cannot manipulate, as you said. So that can't be good news for them.
Yeah, well, it may sound paradoxical, but it increases the potential to have real Russian-American cooperation when America has a strong leader. I mean, I think everybody could see Vladimir Putin had nothing but disdain for Barack Obama. So now with we saw this in negotiations with Russia in the Bush administration. You're not going to agree with them on a lot of things, but if they see you as straightforward and strong, you find ways to work together. So that's the irony, that under Obama, who wanted this reset with Russia and didn't get it, you're more likely to have constructive things because we've got a strong leader and the Russians acknowledge that.
We all know that Putin doesn't have clean hands. He was a former KGB operative, and that means a lot of things to those who follow the KGB. We know about these assassinations. We know about these poisonings. We think that he's implicated in some very serious things. Bashar al-Assad has done some very bad things. So did the former president of Mubarak. So where's the line when you're trying to make an arrangement or cooperate with a country and a leader? And you know, he's not exactly, he doesn't go to Sunday school on Sunday mornings. Where is the line in which we can cooperate?
Well, I think you've got to bring it back to the fundamental point that it has to be in the best interest of the United States. Winston Churchill famously said in World War II that if the devil invaded, or if Hitler invaded hell, that Churchill would find a way to say a kind word about the devil on the floor of the House of Commons. So it's not an absolute test. It depends on how it affects American interest. And if there are ways to cooperate with Russia in the fight against terrorism, I think we ought to take advantage of it. We used Russian airspace to fly supplies and personnel into Afghanistan after 9/11 when we were going after Taliban, and I would do it again in a heartbeat. But there are other interests that we have as well. The fact is that on most issues, Russian national interests are in conflict with American national interests. And that's a reality. That's not going to be changed by a personal relationship.
All right, let's switch continents here, or let's switch geographical areas. Sweden has been in the news, because without going into detail, he just misspoke. He said, last night we saw what happened in Sweden. He was talking about seeing a report from Ami Horowitz about the rape culture and the murder rates in Sweden. All right, so now then they had riots the next day in Sweden. John, in Europe, there's a serious problem. Is that being overreported? What's going on in Europe that they won't come to grips with that?
Well, I think they're just unable to acknowledge that they've made a severe mistake and that the massive flows of people out of the Middle East into Europe have brought with them a significant public safety issue, and it's been accumulating over a period of time. The number of assaults on women in Sweden, in Germany, in country after country in Europe has reached epidemic proportions. The press doesn't report it as such because it's not politically correct. So when you have people, Ami Horowitz, he was on Tucker Carlson's show, the Gatestone Institute does a lot of writing on this. People need to be informed about it because it should affect our thinking in this country as well. And I think you're going to see the impact of this problem in these European elections that are coming up over the course of this year.
And one last thing, the speech codes, I think we have to be really clear, the speech codes that have been adopted in Europe are what's causing the silence, and that is what, because of the international connections we have through Facebook and Google and all of that, this whole business of speech codes and really preventing us from speaking the truth about it is coming our way.
This is what happens when you assault freedom of expression. And, these countries don't have a First Amendment. We can't give it up. And the fact that people are criticized for speaking the truth should not inhibit them, although the pressure is very intense, because people are afraid once they see what's causing the problem, they'll ask for the government to do something.
Well, and I believe that's why President Trump is President Trump.
Could very well be.
Because people are so sick of not being able to speak the truth, however imperfectly. So, Ambassador Bolton, they are telling me that you have to go. And so I would
pleasure
respect
being
that.
With you.
I respect that always. It's great to see you.
Good to see you,
and,
Sandy. Take
next
care.
Next time we read a headline, I wanted to say Ambassador John Bolton is now going to be the in the new White House. I'm waiting for that.
Well, thank you so much.
Okay. All right. God bless you.
Take care now.
Take care of you. Okay.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Good to see you. Okay. Thanks,
bye-bye.
John. We'll see you soon.
Hello, I'm Ed Vitagliano, co-host of Today's Issues each weekday morning on American Family Radio. I'm also Executive Vice President of American Family Association, the parent ministry of AFR. I just want to welcome the many new listeners to the AFR family as we have expanded into several new areas over the past 6 months. Who pays for AFR to stay on the air, you might be asking? Well, the answer is simple. AFR depends on our listeners to make financial contributions so that we can keep our radio stations on the air. If you appreciate the news, talk, information, and inspiration that you receive from AFR each day, we ask that you remember us financially when funds allow. You can make a donation at AFR.net or by calling 800-FAMILIES extension 2. That's AFR.net or 800-FAMILIES. Please keep us in your prayers as we continue to impact America for Christ.
The Tide Radio Ministry is celebrating 69 years of sharing the good news of Jesus Christ. I'm Don Shank, Director of The Tide, and this is today's Global Update. Reflecting on the past 69 years of The Tide Ministry, we marvel at how God took a vision for a local radio ministry, reaching one small town, and transformed it into a global outreach that's bringing people around the world into relationship with Him. Our work now includes discipleship activities and radio programs in 23 languages. Three of those languages were just added this year, and already they're making a difference in the lives of many people. Like Marco, who says our latest Albanian language radio program is a blessing for him. He wrote, "I can learn a lot of things about God and how to live according to His Word. I see how my life is changing because of this program." To learn more about the Tide Ministry and help us share the gospel with more people like Marco, visit thetide.org. That's thetide.org.
Hello, Americans. I'm Todd Starnes with this Fox News and commentary next.
Truett McConnell University.
My name is Peter Koh, and I'm a business major, and this is my junior year at the college. What I love about the athletics here at Truett McConnell University is the coaches and their side of trying to teach sports from a biblical mindset with sportsmanship involved, and it really changes the way that you pursue the game, not just passionately doing it for other people, but also for yourself and to glorify God in that, which is completely different from most other schools.
Are you called? Visit truett.edu today.
Well, I have some bad news for all you Burt Bacharach fans. The Spring Lake Park High School in Minnesota has decided to stop playing music composed by white guys. Marching band director Brian Lucasen tells NPR they only plan to buy music from composers of color. And the truth is, old Burt's about as white as a jar of mayonnaise. The school also pledges to toot their horns to at least one musical selection composed by a woman. Students are hailing the decision, one telling NPR that musicians of color will no longer have to check themselves at the door. I have no idea what that means. Another student said they, too, were bothered by playing a white person's composition. So there you have it, folks. Tolerance and diversity set to music. Mr. Holland's opus, it is not. I'm Todd Starnes.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
It is great to be back at the premier gathering of conservatives in the United States of America. You know, this is the ninth time I've had the privilege to address CPAC. Thanks to all of you and the confidence of our new president, this is the first time I'm here as Vice President of the United States of America. Because of all of you, because of your hard work and your support and your prayers, my family and I have the privilege to serve. And more importantly, because of all of you, my friend Donald Trump is the 45th president of the United States of America. You know, the president and I have become good friends. It's the greatest privilege of my life to be vice president to a leader of such conviction vision, and courage. Now, some people have remarked that we're a little bit different. You know, I'm a small town guy, he's big city. I'm Midwest, he's Manhattan Island. He's known for his bigger than life personality, his charm and his charisma, and I'm like, not. You know, as I said at the Republican convention, I guess he was just looking to balance the ticket. But all kidding aside, when President Trump asked me to join him on the ticket, I said yes in a heartbeat. Because you have elected a man for president who never quits. He never backs down. He is a fighter. He is a winner. And I promise you, he will never stop fighting until we make America great again.
Last night with Vice President Mike Pence, I want you to hear that because he was funny. It was actually funny even just to see him because his expressions were really funny. But that was, you know, it's a time of celebration here. This is a Conservative Political Action conference. This is Sandy Rios, by the way, at National Harbor, Maryland. And it's just fun to be here. There's a lighthearted spirit and optimism and enthusiasm. And it hasn't always been that way. So my friend now, she's become my friend through these many years of knowing her, Ann McElhinney, joins me now. And you've heard Ann before. She has a distinctive voice. I love to hear her speak, but that's not the point. The point is, she and her husband, Phelan, who are journalists, have been working on something that's tough. And it's the story of Kermit Gosnell, that abortion doctor in Philadelphia who... just by happenstance, they discovered the brutality and the grisliness of what was going on inside his clinic. And they made a movie called Gosnell, the Movie, and they are going to be showing it here at CPAC. Thanks for joining me, Ann.
It's great to be here, Sandy.
All right, now you've been showing. I saw it, a sneak preview, a few months ago, and you showed it at another conference. Okay, so when is this movie going to be out? Do you have a release date yet?
No, we don't have a date, but as soon as possible is the plan. I mean, you know, here's a shocker for you, Sandy. You know, Hollywood don't want this film to be seen.
Oh, come on.
You
know?
Yeah,
come on.
I know.
You're such pro-lifers.
I know. So, you know, there has been an awful lot of opposition. This film has been seen by all the major distributors, and all the major distributors have rejected us. None of them, by the way, none of them saying because the film isn't good. None of them saying that. In fact, a lot of them saying, wow, this is incredible. This is powerful. What an amazing story. But not for us. Too controversial for us. And this is complete nonsense. These are the same people, by the way, who put out a film with Lily Tomlin playing a grandmother collecting money for her grandchild's abortion. These are the same people who made a rom-com, a romantic comedy, with a couple bonding over the girl having an abortion of their baby. You know, this is nonsense. These people, the problem is we're on the wrong side of the conversation from their point of view. So what we need to do is we're raising capital from investors. We have to raise a lot of money so that, because if you put a movie out in theaters, which this movie needs a traditional distribution, we're not going to be in fringe, you know, in churches or whatever. This movie needs to be seen by everyone.
Right.
So in order to do that, you need to raise a lot of money, like millions of dollars, so that people know it's on. Basically, the money is raised for advertising. So we're working with John Sullivan. A lot of your listeners know John, who worked with Dinesh D'Souza. And John has a great plan. And, you know, it's funny, the book, as you know, the book came out. People can buy the book at gosnellbook.com. And the book, you know, nearly went to number 3 on all the bestsellers in the United States in the first 24 hours. It sold out on Books a Million. It sold out on Barnes & Noble. It sold out on Amazon.
Wow.
And now they've had to reissue and reprint it and whatever. But the book has kind of shaken people up a lot. A lot of people are reading the book. They're very disturbed. And people really are demanding that the film come out now. So that's helping us a lot, actually. So
did the New York Times list you at all?
So, well, it's quite an interesting story. So I'll give your listeners a education about the New York Times bestseller list. We are New York Times bestsellers. However, they left us off the New York Times hardback nonfiction list. We were number 3. By the numbers, by the actual numbers of books sold, we were number 3 on the New York Times bestseller list of hardback nonfiction. But they just left us off that list, and a lot of our, you know, people, our fans or whatever, really, really objected and got in touch with the New York Times, who then explained helpfully that the New York Times bestseller list is not made up of bestsellers. So, you know, just interesting for you to know. You know, you talk about fake news in a fake newspaper. Well, there you go. There's your fake news feed. So the New York Times bestseller list of hardback nonfiction is a little bit of a fiction based on a thing that they call context. And they don't define context, but it's something that a bunch of them sit around in a room and work out what they think should be on the list, but they don't use the numbers. And, you know, in the past, that could be explained away, you know, that, you know, there was no computers or whatever. You'd have to phone up bookshops and kind of get a picture. Nowadays, it's all freely available. The Amazon, helpfully, refreshed their page every hour. So from an hourly basis, you can work out on Amazon where you're at. And we were number three on Amazon. Amazon.com. We were in the number three book sold. So, you know, but anyway, listen, we're a New York Times bestseller. We're a bestseller. People are really affected by the book. I'd ask people to go to gosnellbook.com, buy a copy, read it in public. People are doing this. We're getting the most amazing messages from people. You know, and also go to get people to go, please, go to the Gosnell Movie Facebook page and like the page, get involved. Also go to gosnellmovie.com and give $1. 29,000 people so far have contributed to make this film possible. And as you said, Sandy, people are going to see that film here today in CPAC. Thanks be to God. Because what's important to us is we're obviously surrounded by, you know, conservative leaders really here. And those people are going to become our champions. So yes, that when the movie comes out, we're going to have those all over the country saying, guys, I've seen this. You need to come. You need to come and see this film. They'll write on social media about it. And, you know, you've seen it, Sandy. So, I mean, I can't be more proud of what's been achieved here. The movie plays very much like a traditional, you know, procedural. It's like a Law and Order episode in a lot of cases, you know, in a lot of senses. And an awful lot of it happens in the courtroom. And we're very proud of the fact that the courtroom drama section of it is based on the transcripts. It's based on what was actually said during the trial. And I think this is, this is going to sound super weird, but the gift of this story, the gift of this horrific story, is the fact that abortion is described in detail by people who believe in abortion. So abortion doctors on the stand at the trial took to the stand, were asked by the prosecution to basically explain to the jury the difference between what Gosnell did and what is legal in the United States of America. And I can tell you, because I've spoken to jurors and interviewed jurors, they found the distinction very minor. And obviously, it was the best person who has described this is Kirsten Powers in the USA Today, who said that, you know, so what Gosnell did outside the womb is murder, but doing the exact same thing 2 or 3 inches in a different direction inside the womb is perfectly legal. And she said it's morally irreconcilable. I love that phrase. That how can you reconcile that? And I can tell you that the jury, who were not pro-lifers, had a hard time reconciling that. And they, in fact, and it's interesting, we're about to hear President Trump is going to speak this morning. A lot of people were very upset about what he said, that women should be, you know, should go to jail and stuff. And it's just interesting maybe for your listeners to know this. The jurors that we interviewed said that.
Oh, that's
They actually said that. And I think what was interesting about that was that I think that Donald Trump has had a journey. I think he was pro-choice and whatever, you know, never really thought about it. But he got an education, like I got an education, like the jurors got an education. And the knee-jerk reaction of a juror when they heard the stories of these women going to this clinic at 8 and 9 months to have abortions, one woman who went on the day she should have delivered her baby to have an abortion, their reaction was, why are the women not being prosecuted? And I just think it's an interesting context for those remarks from President Trump. When we heard President Trump say that, we said, ha, he just sounds like the jury at the Gosnell case.
And do you have any reason to believe he's seen this movie yet?
I do not believe so, but I can tell you we are doing everything in our power to make sure he gets a copy. We know that Kellyanne, we got a copy to Kellyanne. She is obviously, you probably know, a little bit busy, but she was so gracious. We were invited very kindly to the White House the week the book came out, which I'm still that phrase, only in America? Well, only in America, you know, the two Irish turn up at the White House, and it's like we're literally with our jaw slack and our mouths open going, is this actually happening to us? Yeah. And we go in, we meet the Vice President, who I cannot describe. I mean, it's really interesting. Somebody just interviewed me yesterday to talk about meeting the Vice President, and I just thought, what nobility. What a faithful man. I was very impressed by him. He spoke about, he stood there with his wife and his daughter and said, you know, I want to tell everyone here. And there was just a small group of people, the pro-life leadership were there, and then ourselves as journalists who had written this book. And he said, do you remember a few years ago, Time magazine had a cover of the baby in the womb? And he said, we brought our children around together, and there were small children at that stage, he said. And we said, we're going to Washington to save the babies. That's what he said. And we're sort of standing there going, oh my God, this man is extraordinary. And then he does this quotation, and I am no Bible thumper myself, so I don't know the Bible very well, but your listeners would know. 2 Chronicles is what he quotes, and he uses that at the very end of all of his speeches, and he did that. If my people
who are called by my name shall humble themselves and pray and seek my face, and then will I hear from heaven and heal their land. And there's more to it than that.
Heal the land. Yeah. And I just thought, oh my God. So he said that, and we were there, and anyway, just extraordinary. But we got to meet Kellyanne Conway, and it's just a kind of a funny thing for your listeners, because we got like a bit starstruck, right? So Kellyanne Conway walks into the vice president's office, and we're kind of going, oh my God. You know, it's kind of like meeting, you know.
Yeah, sort of, no,
you're a hero, right? So we kind of go up. I actually couldn't speak at all, which obviously, you know me, Sandy, you're thinking that's really weird. Anne couldn't speak. And so Phelan started blurting out, my name is Phelan McAleer, and you know, and shook hands, and you know, we've made a film about Kermit Gosling, we heard about whatever. And she just really calm. I don't know if you've met her, so she's really calm. She's got this wonderful spirit. And she said, I know exactly who you are. And we're kind of going, and the truth is, we're looking at her thinking, she thinks we're someone else. She's mistaken us for someone else. And she said, yeah, you're the guys who did that great Fractionation movie. And we're kind of going, oh my God. And then she says, I'm on your database. I get your emails. And we literally, after we met her, we sent a text to our business partner, Magdalena Segeda, and we said to her, oh my God, would you please check the database? And she said, yeah, Kellyanne's on our database. And Kellyanne has opened all our emails until the summer. And funny enough, she stopped reading our emails in the summer. And I'm thinking, did something happen to Kellyanne in the summer?
Yeah, what happened to her? Why did she fall? What if she fall off the grid?
Isn't that amazing?
No, it is amazing. But that's the way God works, Anne. I mean, he puts a lot of things together. We don't know. We are like pieces of this puzzle. We get stuck in, and we don't really see the picture.
Tell you how much I believe that to be true. The fact that we even came across this story in the first place, Sandy. I mean, this is not our wheelhouse. This is not our stuff. We do the stuff you know. We did Fractionation. We did Not Evil
About Fracking. I need to explain
about
which
fracking,
is a great movie about
which
fracking.
Is on Netflix, by the way, for any listeners who want to watch it. Fantastic film. Yeah. But a lot of what we've done has been, you know, looking at
environment. You're a journalist.
Yeah, looking at the environmental movement. So this was a very big surprise. This story.
You know what? I don't remember how you came across this story. You have to tell me again.
Completely by accident. So we had this film Fractionation. A lot of it was shot in Pennsylvania. Phelan was on his own. He was in Pennsylvania. He had a screening here, screening there, whatever. Had a couple of days off. Was in Philadelphia. You know, shocker. And Phelan is a journalist to his fingertips. It's all in his DNA. He's always sniffing out stories, no matter where we are. The smallest village on the planet Earth, and Phelan will say, you know, somebody got drunk last night and fell off the thing. And he'll be finding the stories out of what the thing, and that guy owns that property, and he's tried to do this guy out of whatever. So he hears about this local crime story, and he goes down to the courtroom, and he walks in, and they had reserved a really large courtroom for this court case because they presumed that there'd be massive media interest. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's an actual fact. They took this huge courtroom. And Phelan goes in, and there's a jury, and opposite the jury, they are projecting the images of the 47 bodies that were recovered in the clinic.
And he didn't even know what he was walking
into. So he's walking in and he starts to see these images. Now, Phelan has covered the war in Northern Ireland. He's no wuss, you know. He's seen everything. And very shocking things. The Oma bomb, for example, he covered for the Irish news. And so he's looking at these images, and then he's listening to the testimony from the expert witnesses and the witnesses who witnessed the deaths of the babies, and some of them who actually participated in the killing of the babies. You know, they were snipped with scissors, as many of your listeners know. And he's sitting there thinking, okay, this is the worst testimony I have ever heard. These are the most shocking images I have ever seen. Truly disturbing. And he looks behind, and he said more shocking for him was that the courtroom was empty. And the only people were there, he said, there were a couple of Mennonite women. Isn't that just a gorgeous, beautiful woman? Mennonite women knitting, who were there witnessing to the children, basically. And that was basically it that was there. There was a couple of local journalists, but the journalism pews, and they had these reserved seats, all empty. So he came back to Los Angeles, and I think you're going to love this. He comes back to Los Angeles and says to me and to Magdalena, you know, this is what we're going to do now. This is now what we're going to do. And we're going, no, we are not doing anything to do with abortion. I don't want anything to do with abortion. And he said, do me a favor. Let me buy the transcripts of the trial for the days I was in Philadelphia. And he did. And he said, just read them. And that was that.
Oh, my goodness.
And we were converted. Like, basically, once you read it, there's no... And we had already... You know, we're filmmakers. The big mystery with filmmaking, I can just break this news to you now, is money. We had money for a different movie. and we sent that money back. That's how committed we were to this. This is 3 years later now, Sandy, and I'm sitting here. The movie is still not in theatres, but my God, it will be. And your listeners can help by going to gosnellmovie.com, give $1 and buy the book, gosnellbook.com, and read it in public and post your photograph to the Facebook page, the Gosnell Movie Facebook page.
And we are out of time. We just had to go on with you. Every time I talk to you.
I'm sorry.
Well, I know you're this way with everybody, but I just see God's hand in your life. I see him working. Because this is what he does. He surprises us, and he has pulled you out to and selected you for this. I really believe that. And it's changing your life and Phelan's life, too.
Well, thank you so much. I can't tell you the people we've met and people who have written to us most beautiful letters from people who have suffered because of abortion. I mean, I can't tell you the people that we've met. One woman who is, I call her a grandmother-to-be that never was. I write about her in the book, actually. And she got in touch with me. Her son's girlfriend had an abortion and lied to him, had an abortion at Gosnell's clinic, and she got in touch with the Philadelphia authorities and wanted to get the baby, wanted to have a Christian burial for the baby. But she has written the most beautiful letters to us, and she said, if we don't meet in this life, we'll recognize each other in glory. How can we go wrong? You know, how can you go wrong with people?
This tough journal. You didn't get that when you were doing Frack Nation, right?
No.
All right. Well, that's very important too. But there's another dimension to life, and it's much deeper. And once you see it, you can't go back. So,
Thank you.
So glad. And McElarney. And by the way, it's gosnellbook.com. It's
the first cries of a newborn baby signal the miracle of life. There are some who believe that life actually begins at that point, that whatever is in the womb is just tissue and could possibly even be an accident. But the Bible shows something quite different. In Psalm 139, it says, "For you formed my inward parts. You knitted me together in my mother's womb. I praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made." Life begins in the womb at the point of conception, and the Bible makes it clear that it's not just tissue, and there are no accidents with God. Life is a precious gift that's meant to be treasured, not destroyed. In fact, life is so valued by God that he sent his son Jesus to be the sacrifice for sin so we could have life with him for eternity. If life is that important to God, shouldn't we do all we can to protect it? For your help in defending the sanctity of human life, thank you. From AFR.
Unwholesome television programs and unnatural social agendas. As believers, we use our religious freedoms to take out the trash in the media and society. Even children's magazines are in the crosshairs. Join 1millionmoms.com and take action.
This is Monica Cole of 1 Million Moms. We need you to sign up and speak up for our children at 1millionmoms.com. We are making the difference.
Heroes inspire us toward greatness. And on the next Focus on the Family, Eric Metaxas shares inspiring stories of William Wilberforce, Eric Little, and Pope John Paul II. You'll hear about the obstacles, trials, and hardships they overcame and how you can do the same on the next edition of Focus on the Family with Jim Daly.
Focus on the Family is heard each weekday morning at 5 o'clock Central on American Family Radio.
How would you describe your health care? If you're like most Americans these days, the word affordable isn't top of mind. Well, here's some good news. There's actually a trusted health care option that is affordable. It's called MediShare. Unlike insurance, MediShare is Christian healthcare sharing, a community of more than 200,000 believers across America who share each other's medical expenses. It's about half the cost of insurance, and it's fully acceptable under the law. And here's the best part. Because MediShare is based on biblical principles, you never pay for things that go against your beliefs. MediShare is affordable healthcare for Christians.
Learn how thousands of Christians can help you save on your healthcare. For your free information guide, call 855-PSALM-23. Not available in Montana. MediShare, affordable biblical healthcare. Call 855-PSALM-23. That's 855-PSALM-23.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. This weekend, the Democratic Party will select its next chairman. The choice will determine not only who will lead what has traditionally been the loyal opposition, it will also determine if that characterization still applies. four decades ago, I had the privilege of working for a great Democratic senator, Henry Scoop Jackson. He epitomized a party that once led the fight against totalitarian ideologies and strove to defend our country against all enemies, foreign and domestic. If the next Democratic National Committee chairman is Minnesota Congressman Keith Ellison, the party will be led by a Muslim Brotherhood-tied radical leftist. If Obama Labor Secretary Tom Perez is chosen, Democrats will be led by a radical leftist who has enabled the Muslim Brotherhood's penetration and subversion of our government. Either way, Scoop Jackson would be horrified. The American people will be too. This is Frank Gaffney.
Sandy Rios in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I was in last week UAE, in Qatar, in Jordan. I'll be in France on Sunday. I was in India a couple weeks before, with the Netherlands a couple weeks before that. All those countries are digitizing their whole country. And within that, they're saying, how do I do inclusive job growth? And the innovation is all about startups. So a country like France, that wasn't even known as innovation and one of the last places you would do business, now has become the startup leader in all of Europe last year with venture capital investment. So there is no entitlement, and it's important that our country move as well. So if you really want to achieve 4% GDP growth per year, which I think is very doable, you really want to achieve 25 million plus jobs over the next 8 to 10 years, you've got to really enable the new generation of startups and create that environment. It starts with regulation in terms of making it easier for companies to do this. It starts with really making America great in the startup community again. And we're not entitled to this. We have to earn it as a country.
All right, Sandy Rios, back with you. That was the chief executive chairman for Cisco. And, you know, when we talk about regulations, by the way, Sandy Rios back with you at National Harbor, Maryland at CPAC. And you knew that, right? It's our pleasure to be here in the midst of all this noise. The president will be speaking in just a little bit, I think 10 o'clock, so about an hour and 10 minutes from now, something like that. So there are a lot of people about. But when we talk about regulations, and actually I've not spoken a lot about that to you, but regulations are a huge problem. And the Obama administration used executive orders and regulations to hamstring so much of our economy. We talk about businesses. We talk about EPA regulations. But in many ways, these regulations have hurt you. That's the dot, the connection maybe that hasn't been made. It really is harmful to the consumer. And so we're going to talk today to Joe Colangelo. And Joe, by the way, is the president of Consumer Research. Hang on a second, Joe. Here we go. He's written a lot of pieces for the Daily Caller, The Hill, The Washington Times, Investors Business Daily, which is one of my favorites, and Wall Street Journal. He's a speaker on major finance-related conferences. He's the co-founder of Golden Coast Mead. He's a former management consultant for Booz Allen Hamilton. He also was a former U.S. Naval Surface Warfare Officer and received the Defense Meritorious Service Medal. You're young, so how did you do all that, Joe, and get to this place? You must have some background that's not even on that sheet.
Sandy, thank you so much for having me on.
Did you come up in a business family?
No, my father was a woodshop teacher, and you know, my mother taught Spanish, and then she did eventually go do compliance on Wall Street.
So how did you, the business part of you, how did that awaken?
That's a good question. You know, the first time I ever got into an entrepreneurial pursuit was Baltus Roll was a golf course near me, and they were having the PGA, and I sold water outside for $3 while it was $4 inside the gate. So I don't know, maybe that was the big bug that bit me.
You know, my dad was a businessman. He always talked business, you know, how much he made every day. We had to ask. If we didn't ask, he was upset. So that was the talk at our dinner table. And so I grew up in a business environment, and I actually thought about running. I've never even told anybody this publicly, but I thought I would own a business someday.
You kind of do. I mean, yeah. Your brand is a business these days. Yeah. However you monetize that, whether it's on the radio or advising people or things like that, everybody is their own business in 2017.
Well, I guess you're right. All right, Joe, let's talk about regulations, because in general, I understand the concept. I think most people do, that the regulations, whether it's environmental regulations or whether it's the banking restrictions, they have strangled commerce and trade. So which part of this do you deal with?
So we focus on pretty much all consumer impact to legislation and regulation. Now, it used to be that if there was a new rule that was going to change the way that businesses operated or the amount of work that people needed to do to comply with, edicts from above, these rules would come in forms of legislation. So it used to be Congress would say, hey, we think that our constituents are in dire need of this or that. And they would pass a law, and that's how regulation would come around. Now it's much more, what we've seen in the last 8 years is a lot more from the administrative state. And the administrative state is, the part of the government that focuses, that is not accountable to constituents. So at the end of the day, the bureaucrat who's writing, how companies need to regulate their water, their puddles on their property, or what limits people can lend at, these people are not held accountable. They're not up for re-election at any point in time.
The bureaucrats are not.
Exactly, these bureaucrats. And so at the end of the day, without that feedback loop, we don't get the policies that are best for consumers. And that's what we've seen a lot over the last 8 years. We've seen a lot of interest groups heavily rewarded, right? If you're an environmentalist, you're very happy with what the EPA's done. But if you're a consumer, you're wondering why your electricity bill's going up every month. You're wondering why you have to run your washer and dryer twice as long to get your clothes cleaned and dried. And at the end of the day, you don't really care about this Energy Star thing. You care about getting your clothes washed and dried.
Yeah. Oh boy, that hits home. That is really amazing how they don't use as much water in washing machines, so your clothes don't get clean. They just don't get clean. And it's amazing. My husband and I actually just bought. This is really fascinating conversation. We did just buy a new washer, and we managed to find one that still works the old-fashioned way, yeah. Fills the tank up, and has the agitator. And we felt like we'd won a prize because our clothing that we were washing was just not ever even totally wet.
Well, you're talking about consumer choice there. So, see, you and your husband can choose between the efficient, low-water-using washer or the old clunky one that uses more.
You can't hardly find the old one, though. They've regulated them out of existence.
Exactly. So the ability for consumers to choose is one of the most important parts of this competitive free market, right? So consumers can say, well, I really like that there's this efficient one, and they can choose. Some consumers will choose that, and then people like you and I will say, well, I'm willing
to
spend I'll use a little more water and clean my clothes better.
Yeah. Since we're going this direction. The toilets, the Al Gore toilets,
right.
they're maddening.
Flush them
it's just
three
like,
times.
Yeah, exactly. Just foolishness. The light bulbs.
So the
light bulbs that we can't get. We used to have really bright lights, and now we have these ridiculous light bulbs that we have to buy. But anyway.
You turn them on, and it takes a while for them to warm up. The room seems really dim for a while. I'm finding the same thing.
We used to have, just light bulbs that you put in, and they actually lit up the room, like Thomas Edison designed. But. All right, so when you examine these things, the point is that these regulations, we could talk about their effect on business. I'm sure you do talk about that some. I have talked about how many of the regulations they have put into place, like with EPA, have actually they've got criminal penalties on them, where people are paying fines and are losing property and are just... The untold story is the treatment of regular people over these... regulations. So tell us what the most egregious one is that you guys have been tracking.
Sure. So, we talked about just now, about things that consumers really understand impact them, right? So if you're a consumer, you understand that an Energy Star mandate, something that makes your appliances work in a certain way impacts you. But what we focus on generally is, more importantly for us, is showing how consumers how regulations and policy that they don't think affects them actually does affect them. So,
like?
The Clean Power Plan, for example.
The Clean Power Plan, that was Obama's big idea.
Right. So
it's still in place, right?
Exactly. EPA, led by Gina McCarthy, said, we are going to kind of move beyond our mandate of protecting, keeping water clean, keeping... Superfund sites moving in the right direction and cleaning up, lots of contaminated areas. We're going to say how many CO2 particles power plants can emit. And at the end of the day, that's still being challenged in court, whether they have the authority to do that. But that is expected. And this is the rosiest estimates from the Obama, CBO. And they are expecting that we'll add $270 billion in regulations to the cost to the power industry over the next 10 years. So if you look at that $270 billion, do you think that power plants are just going to lose $270 billion? No, they're going to raise rates on consumers. So if consumers are wondering why their power bills are going up by $70 or $100 every year, it's because of these regulations. And the regulations are not on consumers, they're on the businesses. But those costs get passed right along.
Well, and of course, we knew this was going to happen if people had been paying attention when Barack Obama said that energy rates were not going to necessarily skyrocket. Yeah, and that's because with their worldview, they want to punish people for making their houses cooler or keeping their houses warmer, because according to their worldview, it's not fair. We should be more like the third world. It's just it's an unbelievable, actually. And I guess the question has to be asked, Joe, what if we do keep our houses warm and cool in the summer? Does that hurt someone? Are we running out of nuclear power, or are we running out of power so that we shouldn't be doing that, or is this really all about philosophy?
Well, I mean, it's a good. In order to accept that the clean power plant is the best is a good outcome, you need to accept that the Earth is warming. You need to accept that this is due to human causes, and that this is a bad thing. So if you accept those three things, then you have to take a further leap and say that the only way to stop this is by drastically limiting our CO2, even if there's no limiting on other countries on their CO2, right? So those are all the kind of leaps of faith that you need to take. I'm not a scientist, and so my opinion on global warming is kind of squat. But it's a long trail of things, and at the end of the day, whether those are all correct or whether those are all wrong, the process is so important. And the process of laws being passed by people who are accountable to their constituents is what is being ignored. And ignoring that is a really dangerous thing.
I should know this, but the Clean Power Plant, was that an executive order, or was that something passed by Congress?
No. So the Clean Power Plan was just a plan drawn up by Gene McCarthy, the head of the EPA, and not approved or...
the duly unelected head of the EPA.
No, Scott Pruitt's...
Scott Pruitt is there now, a former Attorney General of Oklahoma, who is the opposite side of the spectrum. He would be where I sit. And what do we expect? I mean, under Donald Trump, under President Trump, do you think that will be reversed, that particular...
I do. I think the Clean Power Plan will be reversed. And, Scott Pruitt is a... if you pay attention to the media, he's out to destroy the environment, right? But what he's going to be doing is returning the EPA to its roots of protecting the environment.
Really, so protecting the environment.
Really protecting
the environment.
From
pollutants, from, water not being clean. Nobody wants that.
No.
Nobody wants to go back to the days where, we couldn't breathe because the air was filled with particles, and that's the way it has been. It was in the 80s and 70s,
right.
Yeah.
Nobody wants that. Nobody wants a paint factory pouring, their pollutants into the river. Nobody should be allowed to do that. And that's the EPA's job. And, the government does have a job in protecting the environment. And I'm not going to get here and say, everybody should be allowed to do whatever they want. But when they take the job that is so important of protecting our rivers, protecting the air quality, and they go and extend it to all these other areas, that's when the EPA loses credibility.
Well, Joe, very interesting. Consumer Research, consumerresearch.org.
Yep, so consumersresearch.org and on Twitter at consumersfirst.
Okay, so then people can find out where some of these regulations
are
and just kind of educate maybe business owners and other people. All right, Joe Colangelo, thank you so much.
Thank you, Sandy.
Live from CPAC, Sandy Rios, have a great day.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.